At 9 a.m. on a windy weekday morning, people are trudging to work at the Sprint headquarters in Overland Park. Not exactly in droves, like in the early 2000s when this campus was new. The 9 a.m. rush these days is more of a scattering of people. The 17 stately brick buildings that make up the Sprint headquarters have the feel of a college campus on winter break. Although the facility was designed for 14,500 employees, only about 6,000 actually work there. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and today we're feeling nostalgic for the days when a job at Sprint was the standard for reliable employment in Kansas City. Where are people turning for that kind of security today? We'll get to that question, but first, this city is crawling with people who have been laid off by Sprint at some point or another, so we've invited one of them in to tell his story. We hope some of the newly laid off will find it reassuring. Walter Fulbright, good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about yourself. What was going on in your life in general when Sprint came along?
Well, this is interesting because I had actually come off of another what you would call a boom-bust cycle because I had worked in real estate. And real estate, of course, during the early 2000s has its own unique story of growth and collapse. So I had
what they call a bubble.
Exactly. There may have been a movie recently about this.
There may have been.
Yes. So I had come out of that, and of course, it was a similar sort of thing. Like everyone had a real sense of enthusiasm about working in real estate, and this was something that was never going to go away. We were all going to provide for our families and be well off.
Live long, prosper.
Exactly. And so when that went away, we all had a transitional period, and that's when Sprint went through one of their great hiring surges. And
can I ask about this transitional period? Because people say that, like, for those of us who have never been through that boom-bust cycle you just described, I mean, what does that feel like, the transitional period? Can you flesh that out?
I can. It definitely feels sort of like getting getting the rug pulled out right from underneath you. It feels like, okay, this is why I went to school. This is why I worked so hard to get where I was. Like, I've got this respectful, good job. And, you know, especially we're talking about mortgages and later Sprint. These are jobs that this is what you had gone to school for. This is why you had worked so hard. This is what you had, okay, you've made it. Now this is when you start acquiring the house and the children and the cars and from then on. And then one day you realize I'm delivering pizza north of the river. And that can happen over just a couple week period, and you realize no one is immune to this.
So that's what you were doing during that first transitional period?
I was. That's immediately what I could get doing. I remember it was winter, and I had a car, and that was what was available, and that's what we did.
And so Sprint appeared in the picture for you how?
Sprint has a history of, like I said, having these like hiring surges, and so a mutual friend of ours actually told me, hey, I have this opportunity, like they've got this great new project going on at Sprint. It's going to be this wonderful job, great benefits. We're all going to get on and we're going to be happy and have our weekends to ourselves and everything will be peachy. And so honestly, maybe 2 weeks later, we were all starting.
A bunch of friends of yours?
Absolutely. I would say that between the referrals that came to me and then after, I probably knew 30 people who all started at Sprint at the same time.
So that sounds like a lot of fun, going to work with a bunch of your friends.
It absolutely is.
When you talk to people in town about going to work for Sprint at that time, what was the typical response? Can you remember a citywide attitude?
Well, this was not the first time that Sprint had hired a lot of people, nor was it the first time that they had also laid off a similar number of people. And so the general feeling, especially considering knowing where I'd been, was, well, that's fantastic. I'm so happy that things are looking up for you. This will be a great opportunity for you. I'm sure that you'll find your feet and everything will go very well.
How would you describe the work culture there? I mean, what year are we talking about?
This was 2005, so
yeah.
It was the work culture at Sprint was, it was interesting because despite you'd mentioned the Sprint campus and its history, Sprint, even during the time when that campus was half full, completely full, has had employees just all over this city. They've held these leases on buildings all around town, and so you never knew like where you could end up. I think I worked in Lenexa, I worked in the West Bottoms, But the group of people that I ended up with, it was really like optimistic, and it kept growing, and they kept having to add more space and move to bigger and bigger buildings. And you just felt, okay. I personally was a little nervous because it felt a lot like the real estate bubble. It felt
How so? What were the symptoms, if you will?
There's sustainable growth and there's unsustainable growth. And anytime you, back then, during to compare it to real estate, like houses going up double in value in 2 years and the Western time zones, you wonder to yourself, like, how long can this really last? Like, this is to the point where, and just how many people could Sprint add during this couple of period of time? Like, it just felt like there was far too much. And honestly, even a year in, it was pretty clear there wasn't enough work for all of us to do. I'm not going to lie. So,
it was kind of cushy.
I am going to say cushy. I hope that none of my former bosses are listening. If they are, I apologize. But yeah, there was a lot of downtime.
So when were you laid off? And I mean, had you seen it coming? Were there rumors about impending layoffs before the news came?
There was, and I was in the first round of layoffs. Actually, I had decided to take a voluntary layoff because the writing was pretty clearly on the wall.
But so why take a voluntary layoff and not just hold on to that job as long as you could or hope for the best?
The hope is that they were giving a pretty generous severance package, and the hope now is that you can take what is guaranteed now versus what might not be guaranteed in 6 months.
How did you handle that? I guess doing it voluntarily means you had some time to kind of make the decision on your own terms and maybe talk to relatives or anyone who needed to be a part of that conversation.
Well, this had actually gone along with, this is where the safe jobs conversation I think really comes into play, is at this point, I had lost faith that safe jobs were even a possibility for our generation, let alone for any specific company. Or I believed that the only way was that we were going to all strike out on our own and make our own peace. We were going back to the Oklahoma land rush, basically, of the economy.
How did you handle this new transitional period when it came upon you?
I had spent a few months kind of processing because I might have mentioned I had a little bit of downtime there as things were ramping down. So I had conceived of other things that I could do on my own. Like, I had gotten struck with the spirit that the internet was going to save us all. So I was going to launch my own internet company, and I decided ahead of time, okay, this is what's going to happen here. This is what life is going to be like. It's time that we come up with our own ideas and execute them. So I was well prepared.
Can I make sure I understand this? It sounds like you could tell that there wasn't enough work for as many people as were working, and therefore you had not too busy of a schedule, and you used the space that gave you to prepare for what was next because you kind of saw what was coming.
Let's say the mental space, just to make sure that I'm on the right side. I continue to do my duties there, but unquestionably you're going to wander and think, okay, where is my life at and what am I doing? And like you said, you're around all these people who believe Sprint is the dream. We've all gotten this great safe job, but the unease definitely gave me a different perspective on that.
What do you do now?
I am a data analyst at a marketing company here in town.
Does that feel safe to you?
It does. It absolutely does. And I'm not just saying that because they're probably listening, because I had to take time off for this interview. So, and they have radios. So.
They have radios. I can't believe it.
Yes. Yes. We'll find out if we do a call in, we'll see if they're there. But yes, it does feel a lot different because I can see sustainable growth. And like I said, that's really like the big indicator is the boom bust cycles of business can be so traced to how sustainable is this amount of growth that they're asking for or looking for. Does it feel like they're trying to bleed everything they can before they cash in their chips? And it doesn't feel like that.
From the standpoint of an employee, I'm curious what it is you see that tells you this looks sustainable.
I think generally speaking, if a business does not grow at a third the rate that the staff does, that to me seems this is not going to last.
Well, Walter Fulbright, data analyst and former Sprint employee, hang on while we get some analysis, okay?
Absolutely.
I'd like to turn now to Frank Lenk with us from the Mid-America Regional Council. Frank, Would you agree with Walter's analysis of what is sustainable and what isn't in a workplace, and what constitutes safety for an employee?
I think so. I think he was driving at that in this day and age, there really aren't very many safe jobs. He was talking about for his generation, maybe the internet would be the salvation, but the internet opens you to as much competition as it does sort of access to new markets. And so,
and there was, I believe, a bubble that was called the dot-com bubble.
Business being created and being invested in. That's also part of the sort of overall financialization of the economy, which is part of what's driving, you know, Sprint and others. They have to be very concerned about meeting quarterly earnings targets instead of sort of long-term growth potential. And it's made it harder to invest in labor and treat labor as an asset rather than just a cost. And so if labor is only a cost, then you can, you know, raise your bottom line by cutting those costs, and labor's the, you know, the biggest cost, and so firms keep cutting.
Walter told us his story. I mean, two of his stories actually about transitional periods after being laid off by companies. Is his story? I mean, how do you characterize the transitional period when it's bigger than just one person you're looking at? When you're looking at a whole population in a transitional period?
Well, there's two ways. One, in a normal period, we call that frictional unemployment because there's always people who are changing jobs. But when everyone is trying to do it at once, we call that a recession. and that's the issue, that aggregate demand has slumped. Businesses don't see any prospects for things getting better soon. They start cutting costs like crazy. They lay off lots of workers who then don't have nearly the money to spend that they used to, which causes a further drop in demand, causes further losses at businesses, and they cut further. And this continues until you reach some kind of bottom. And whether you support it or not, you know, some of the things that both the Federal Reserve and the government, what the federal government was able to do to sort of put a floor on that bottom and do it relatively quickly were helpful. And then we sort of stayed on that bottom maybe for a lot longer than people would have liked. But now we finally are adding jobs at a national level.
In Kansas City, I mean, we've talked about Sprint, but Sprint is not alone in going through waves of layoffs in recent years. What are some other fields or other kinds of employers that have been letting people go in Kansas City?
Well, you know, manufacturing has come back a little bit, but manufacturing is down certainly from its peak, as is construction. Construction is way off still from where it was during the building boom and the building bubble.
How does it affect a city? We talked about that a recession is what you have when, on a large scale, lots of people are out of work, looking for work at the same time. But how does it affect a city when there's significant numbers of people needing jobs all at once because of a local employer having layoffs and often having skill sets and resumes that look very similar to one another? Has every time period seen this pattern of entire industries like rising and falling in less time than the span of a single worker's career, or is this special to the current workforce?
Not sure if I understand the question entirely. I will say that when we analyze the economy and Kansas City's performance, and Kansas City as a region did great during the 1990s when Sprint was doing great, after the dot-com bust and the recession in the early part of the 2000s, Sprint didn't do as well, and the region's economy as a whole competed less effectively against other metros. And so roughly sort of half the decline in our sort of regional competitiveness can be attributed simply to what was going on at Sprint. So we have a big employer. It's a really important employer because it's pulling in dollars from around the country and around the world into our region. That's what makes regional economies grow. And that company stops doing as well, it hurts. It hurts a lot. And so we have a diverse economy. Sprint's just one of many employers, but it still was a big enough player that we believe about half the region's sort of loss of economic competitiveness can be attributed to what was going on at Sprint.
Do you think that overall that we do have an economy now where things kind of come and go, here today, gone tomorrow? Is that just part of the nature of today's economy and job market?
Well, it does seem like that the only competitive advantage is innovation, and that makes for a more dynamic economy, which means both growth and, you know, births and deaths, if you will. And Joseph Schumpeter, the great Austrian economist, called that process creative destruction, and that the economy as a whole benefits from that, and that you don't want to stop the firm deaths, and you don't, and you want to encourage more firm births. And we seem to be in an especially dynamic phase, I would say, right now, because, you know, internet businesses can go in and out of business overnight. So there's certainly a part of that. But overall, one of the interesting things, despite that, sort of overall firm formation has declined everywhere. Over the last 20 years, we are not really creating as many firms as you might think, and as many as we used to. And so, that's still a bit of a puzzle. We don't really quite understand why that is, when the internet should make things a lot easier for people to start businesses. So, it's a very dynamic time, and innovation is key, and also, you know, keeping costs low and competing globally. There's all these kinds of forces that are out there that make it harder to just grow slow and steady and be assured that things are going to be the same, because the world is changing, it seems, more rapidly than ever.
Are there resources for people who are needing to reinvent themselves at some point, like some midpoint in their careers regionally?
Sure. So there's people who are a lot more knowledgeable about this than I, but there's a whole group of folks that are concerned with workforce and workforce preparation and retooling for older workers and so on. And we are involved in some of those efforts. We have an effort called GradForce KC around education, raising educational attainment. And one target is the people that, you know, have some college but no degree. I mean, a degree tends to make you more resilient to these kinds of downturns than not, but obviously not impervious, because one of the other lessons of this last recession is that, you know, even middle management and technical professionals are subject to layoffs in this day and age. And I think that is one of the bigger differences. It used to be that during a recession, white collar jobs were safe and the blue collar jobs were the ones that were let go. Now everyone is sort of at risk.
Can you repeat the name of the program you're referring to?
So we have a program here called GradForce KC in conjunction with the educational and workforce community. Sherry Gonzalez-Warren here is in charge of that program. But there are workforce investment boards in both Kansas and Missouri, so the Full Employment Council on the Missouri side is one of them. Workforce Partnership on the Kansas side are two of the firms whose job it is to help people, you know, find employment if they've been laid off. There is a whole system. I'm not the best one to describe it, honestly, for folks trying to find new employment. But what is common is increasingly employers are discovering that they don't necessarily need people with degrees; they need people with skills. And there's a lot of demand for technical skills, STEM skills, science, technology, engineering, and math. And community colleges and universities are doing a better job of providing those kinds of, as well as the for-profit community, providing sort of short training over a 3 to 6 month period that does prepare people for jobs that are available today. And so that's one option for folks.
On a personal level, Frank Lenk, not to put you on the spot or anything, but would you say that your job is secure?
So I'll go back to no job is secure. So I've been here at Mark for 37 years, so in one sense I'm secure. I'm a department director and so on. So I'm, in that sense, it's secure. But the world is a changing place. We depend upon grant revenue from the federal government and services to local governments and to the community at large, and We always have to be reinventing ourselves to do what is useful and valuable for the market. Our market's a little bit different than the private market, but we're serving the community market space. And so if there's not sort of continuous learning, continuous improvement, continuous innovation, then no job is safe.
Frank Lenk of the Mid-America Regional Council, thanks for joining us. I, for one, hope that your job is safe.
Thank you.
What do you think? Is there such a thing as a safe job in Kansas City today? 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. Remember when Sprint was the place where Kansas Cityans looked for a nice, secure job that would always pay the bills? We're searching for the new safe job, the kind of job that you can go into for the sake of a good, steady income and long-term security. Is that a thing of the past, or do you know where to find it? 816-235-2888. Tell us where you think the safe job has gone. We've asked this question about safe jobs on Twitter, and one reply that really intrigued us was Rihanna Weiler. She said that freelance is the new safe job. Rihanna, what do you mean by that? I mean, typically we think of freelance as the freelance lifestyle as a trade-off where you give up the security of a reliable paycheck for the freedom and flexibility of taking it one assignment at a time.
Right. Well, I see it as, you know, having a job, you've got all of your eggs in one basket, whereas my income is dispersed amongst several clients. And so if I lose one client, I have several more to support me, and, you know, I can keep looking for more work. So it feels very stable in that way.
What about cash flow, like steady cash flow, health insurance, sick leave, retirement, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for one thing, I graduated in 2008 and couldn't find a job because it was a recession and everyone was getting fired. As you've been talking about. So, like, I've never had that stability, and so I don't really know what it feels like. But personally, I like being able to, you know when I can go on vacation ahead of time and, you know, let my clients know. And I like being able to shop for my own insurance. You know, I mean, that's a huge thing for me. I know I get to pick my own insurance rather than an employer telling me what my insurance is.
Tell me more about yourself. I mean, what field do you work in?
I'm a graphic designer.
So, I mean, you're talking about you're a graphic designer who entered the workforce freelance in 2008. Take me back to your prospects at 2008 as just a beginning freelancer with really, you know, no previous career or portfolio to point to.
Yeah. Well, my college was actually really great helping me get internships. So I had 2 years of internships, and the one that I was doing my senior year, I thought was going to lead to a job. And then right as I was graduating, they said, oh, no, never mind. We'll let you internship for a little bit longer, but no job. So I did kind of think that I was going to get a job, and then it didn't happen. And then I was looking for a specific job because I had big dreams out of college, and I wanted to work for a magazine. So I started looking around at magazines, and the one I found that was hiring was completely freelance basis. So all the writers and all the designers were freelance. So that's kind of how it started for me. And then, like, it just snowballed from there, getting more projects.
As a freelance person, it's true that you can't be laid off, but does the fate of your biggest clients still have your security kind of bound up with it? I mean, sure, you're freelance, but you need certain businesses to thrive if you're going to get a paycheck. And I'm guessing you need certain businesses within one industry to thrive.
I don't really see it like that. I mean, for one thing, I see like the amount of work I get is based on how hard I'm working to get work, you know? It's all like, you can't control being fired, but I can control how much work I'm getting based on like how much I'm getting out there and meeting new clients and things like that. So I feel very in control.
Hold that thought, because I have some questions about the role of the freelancer or contract laborer in this whole downsizing equation. Joshua Rosenblum is an economics professor with the University of Iowa, and I'm hoping he can answer my question. Joshua, do you think companies turn more and more to freelancers to do work as they downsize?
Hi, Gina. Good morning. And just to correct that, I'm actually at Iowa State University. So,
those are different.
Throw any punches, but yeah, my employer would be unhappy if we got that wrong.
We can't have that. No, sorry. Iowa State University.
Sure. Certainly, I think that in an age of downsizing, employers do turn to freelancing. We see one of the discussions in the economics profession has been about the way in which laws that guarantee employment security, which are characteristic in a number of European countries, have discouraged employers from hiring workers. And so what you find is that employers, when they know that the world is uncertain, when they anticipate that the demand for their products is going to be variable, they are reluctant to take on employees if they have to make a commitment for a very long time period. And so freelance, when it's available, gives them the opportunity to be more flexible.
I have a lot of friends who work in the arts, and one of the dynamics I've noticed is that after layoffs, people will be brought in for freelance work and will feel a certain kind of like guilt over the idea that they are filling that hole that used to be someone's job. And it's something that I felt after a lot of print layoffs were happening. I was a freelance journalist, and yeah, is there any validity to that feeling of guilt that you're sort of like enabling that process?
Well, I suppose you can feel guilty about it. I think that it's a little bit like trying to outlaw gravity. We could impose more stability in one way or another, and we would probably wind up collectively suffering more than we do. We would spread the costs out, and I think that this is one of the challenges that we face in a complicated economy and a complicated society like the United States, is that the flexibility that comes with freelance, with a more responsive economy, it generates benefits for us collectively. It generates the economic growth and improves standards of living, but it entails costs that are concentrated for some people. And if we don't have a social safety net, if we don't have protections that help people to make those transitions of the kind that we were hearing about earlier, going from working in real estate to delivering pizzas, for example, then we're putting the burden of those kinds of transition costs on a very small segment of society.
So do you think that Rihanna is right, that freelance employment is the most secure kind of employment out there, this don't put your eggs in one basket approach?
Well, I think that this is really in the realm of psychology and how one feels about it. I think that there is an element of what's certainly true about freelance is that there is an element of control that you have over your own fate. If you're working at a company like Sprint and you are, as we were hearing about earlier, in a group of people who have been hired and which is growing rapidly because the managers are making a particular bet, you are at the fate of those managers about whether they have read the market right, whether they are making the right decisions about when to invest and when to cut back. And if you're freelance, you take all of that out of the equation and you become dependent on yourself. And I think in some sense, the message is that even if you are working for a large organization, you do have to take responsibility for figuring out what is the value that you bring to that organization, what is the value that you could bring to any other job, and paying attention to that.
How would you say, I mean, with the way that the job market is changing right now, what are some of the most significant changes that you're observing, whether they've already come up in this conversation or if they're elsewhere?
Sure. I think that one of the things that is true is that in some sense, the period from the end of the Second World War really into the late 1980s or 1990s was in some ways an economically exceptional period in the United States. And so for older workers, for people who are looking at their parents' experience, what we're looking at is a set of circumstances that are very different from the ones that are present today. And you can see that in a variety of different indicators that are collected consistently. So there is certainly a decline in job attachment that you can see in the data that the Bureau of Labor Statistics collects, for example. I think what is particularly striking is a phenomenon that is noted in a book called The Second Machine Age by Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee. What they note is the way in which the very rapid advance of computer technology has changed the equation for workers. For most of the last 250 years, technologies have largely enhanced the productive power of human beings and have relied on humans to be the source of control and direction. And in the last 15 years, and especially in the last five, if you can't help but read about driverless cars, for example, computer capabilities to assume complicated discretionary tasks that previously only people could do have just leapfrogged. They have grown very quickly, and this has meant that all kinds of jobs that were previously very secure, white-collar jobs, managerial jobs, clerical and professional jobs, have become much more prone to the potential for automation and therefore at threat.
Let's hear what some of our callers are telling us about the nature and where we can find safe jobs now, especially in Kansas City, but in general, at 816-235-2888. We've got Frank and Lee Summit on the line. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
What can you share with
us?
Hi.
I'd love to share with you. I sort of kind of disagree with some of your callers and the gentleman who just spoke, just the tiniest little bit. I'm a baby boomer, so obviously much of my experience was following World War II, but I've had the same job for 40 years. I'm a registered professional nurse. I have never in my career, I just retired, had an opportunity to work less than 60-hour weeks if I chose to. I always had at least one job, often two or three. And as the baby boomers like I age, the need for healthcare workers, particularly registered nurses, grows exponentially. And that's one of those tasks that you can't automate. What I did for my living can't be automated.
So there's a deeply human quality in your work. And I think, Joshua Rosenblum, weren't you just kind of saying that basically, like, if your job could be automated, that puts you in peril? So the converse of that would be if your job can't be automated, it is maybe secure.
Well, I think that's right. I think Frank is absolutely right that I mean, there are really two pieces to the equation. One of them is how easy is it to figure out and describe what you're doing in terms of rules, and the other is to look at who's going to consume what you're producing. And with the demographic changes that Frank alluded to, there certainly is going to be growing demand for healthcare, and the kinds of work that nurses do is at the moment very complicated and not prone to easy automation. I think we can see in some areas of healthcare there are areas where automation is going to start to have an effect. So, for example, radiologists, people who read X-rays or other imaging expert systems that can identify anomalous features in those are becoming better, and at some point will become more systematic than human eyes. But I think the kinds of caring occupations, the human contact occupations that Frank is engaged in are likely not to be automated for a very long time. So they are safe.
We've been asking this question about where the safe jobs are on the air through social media and using our network of citizen reporters. And we actually got lots of people telling us that nursing is a safe job. We also got a call saying that services that have to be performed at a specific location are safe. The caller's example was plumbing. You don't go online and order a plumber from Amazon. You need a person nearby to come and do this work immediately. And it's not optional. I mean, you have to do it. What do you think?
Well, I think again that's very, there's a lot of truth in that, and it is the case that I think that fits the pattern that we've been talking about. So yes, I think that there are some things that are going on there. There are pieces of that potentially are changing. But being a plumber in some sense is a freelancer of the sort that we were talking about earlier.
You know, Walter Fulbright, former Sprint employee, who you've been talking to us about your story. Do you think that looking back on the jobs that you've had, do you think that they had automation potential? And do you think that that is part of what was making them maybe obsolete?
I think both Frank and Joshua are really spot on with that. And there's a question of sort of one of the baby boomer jobs was the generic office environment job, the white shirt and tie, that was very specific to the company you worked in. It was clerical. I think that word was specifically mentioned. So absolutely, those were less likely to be relevant as time went on and those things were replaceable.
KCUR Central Standard has to take one more short break. When we come back, we'll be wrapping up this conversation about the past, present, and future of the safe job in Kansas City and beyond. You have just a couple minutes left if you want to chime in at 816-235-2888. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've been searching for steady, secure employment in Kansas City in 2016. Our guests are former Sprint employee Walter Fulbright, freelance graphic designer Rihanna Weilert, and economist Joshua Rosenblum with us from Iowa State University. We're going to get back to our calls in just a second, but Joshua, as an economist, do you have the sense that the way we've set up our society has adapted to the way work has changed? Or do we still sort of pretend that work looks just like it used to? I'm thinking about everything from health insurance and how we get it to daycare schedules and the expectation that professionals work in offices with meeting spaces between the hours of 9 and 5.
No, I think that we're in the midst of a transition and that the systems that we have set up are being stressed and strained, and that, for example, the provision of health care through employer-provided plans is really an artifact of the Second World War, of a period when employers were prohibited from raising wages but were trying to retain workers. And This was one mechanism that they could use to help to keep workers in place. Tying healthcare benefits to a particular job is really, in this day and age, dysfunctional in many regards. And that's one example. Retirement plans are also often tied to particular employers. And we do have a system of social insurance, but it is increasingly under strain and incomplete. And one could go on. I think that we really ought to be looking at ways in which the larger social safety net could be enhanced to support people in freelance work.
Rihanna, is this something that you have dealt with and that you have ideas about how to improve?
I agree that it's strange to me, being in freelance, that healthcare is tied to employment, and I kind of have my own ideas on how I'm going to save for retirement. It feels very strange the way the employment is set up in that way, that kind of forces you to do one particular thing, you know.
Where do you come up with your ideas about how to save for retirement? I mean, your expertise is in graphic design, and by no means does that mean that you're not going to have a brilliant idea about how to save for retirement, but that's not the same as having a whole department at your company that kind of manages that.
Yeah. I think it's going to come. I'm not 30 yet, so I'm still, like, working on it, but, I'm planning on doing a lot of research, just knowing that I can have, you know, a varied amount of options. I'm investing in a rental property. So there's a lot of things going on, and I feel like it's nice to have the flexibility to pick it myself.
Let's talk to John in Leawood. Hi, John.
Hello. Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask your guest what kind of world he sees where virtually anything can be automated. Where would people fit in an environment like that?
Like, what is the role of people in an automated?
What role do people serve in a world where virtually anything is possible and can be automated?
And I would add to that, Joshua Rosenblum, how do we put food on our tables in that world?
Well, this is... I think that we're still a long way from that, there are some interesting notions. Brynjolfsson Olsen and McAfee, who describe this emerging world, argue that we won't have a shortage of things because we'll have automated this, but what we will need to do is provide everybody with a guaranteed minimum income so that they can consume them. Because, of course, if we can produce lots of things and no one can buy them, then they're not very valuable to the people who own the machines that can produce them.
So you're talking about just providing people with income. That sounds
that's one. No, it doesn't. But I think that more generally we're still in a world in which economists are prone to talk about the notion of comparative advantage, and it is still the case that for the foreseeable future of all of us, there will be things that people do better than machines, and that rather than seeing it as a competition between people and machines, that we need to think about how people can work with automation, with computer algorithms, with those things to make both people and the automated machines or processes more effective.
You know, with the research that you are doing from the state of Iowa, we have just a moment left, but I'm curious whether the Midwest faces any particular challenges given the particular industries that have historically thrived here.
I guess this is a point at which we should note that, you know, 100 years ago, 40% of the labor force was employed in agriculture, and today it's 2%. What that suggests is that in the long run, the economy is very resilient to the kinds of technological changes that displace certain jobs. And so I think as long as there are people who want to consume things, there will be people who there will be a need for people to produce them or to be involved in their production.
So agriculture providing sort of a model for how a declining industry can fail to result in all of us being just destitute.
Right, exactly.
Well, Joshua Rosenblum, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Rihanna, Walter, your stories have been so illuminating. Thank you both.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me.
In other local industry news, one of the big hopes in Kansas City is that a focus on entrepreneurship will generate new jobs. Adam Arredondo strongly believes in that dream. He co-founded the Kansas City Startup Village, as well as Startland, a website for local news about tech and innovation. But he thinks there's something holding us back in Kansas City. I'll let him explain.
Let me start off by saying that I love Kansas City. I love the humility. I love the blue-collar work ethic. I love the hospitality. I love the low cost of living. In fact, I couldn't be more proud to be a Kansas Cityan. After the World Series, I wore Royals or Kansas City gear every day for an entire month. Not only do I love Kansas City, but I'm as passionate as anyone about helping our city reach its full potential. I often say that Kansas City is my startup. With the revitalization of downtown, the momentum of our entrepreneurial community, and the success of our sports teams, there is no reason why Kansas City cannot be a world-class 21st century city. However, there is one big thing holding us back, and it's actually one of the very things that makes us great. It's Kansas City nice. If you're from KC, you know exactly what I'm talking about. It's our endless desire to make everyone feel wanted, welcome, and comfortable. However, that desire is killing the innovative companies we so badly want to succeed. Often, when I go to meetings with Kansas City leaders, the real conversations happen in the parking lot afterwards. This is a huge problem. We sit in meetings and bite our tongue in order to keep everyone happy, but we're hurting ourselves in the long run. If we can't give and receive honest, constructive, face-to-face feedback, we'll never be one of America's most entrepreneurial cities. If we don't take the opportunity at civic events to celebrate successes, but also challenge our shortcomings, just because it makes a few people uncomfortable, we'll never be one of America's most entrepreneurial cities. If we don't invite Kansas City's highest potential startups to participate in discussions to build programs and resources to support them, because their feedback might disrupt the status quo, we'll never be one of America's most entrepreneurial cities. If we don't establish measurable goals for our entrepreneurial efforts because we're too risk-averse to take bold action and hold ourselves accountable, we'll never be one of America's most entrepreneurial cities. People are nice because they care. I've talked with countless early-stage entrepreneurs over the years that keep their mouths shut to play the KC Nice game. But now is the time we must change or risk being left behind. There are many questions that deserve frank answers. Why do entrepreneurs and civic leaders have such drastically different opinions about the availability of capital for startups in Kansas City? Why aren't our highest potential innovators and civic leaders discussing how to build America's most entrepreneurial city together? Why aren't college students a more integral part of our entrepreneurial community? Why do many corporations view startups as competition for talent? Why is there such little diversity in our startup community? I could continue, but these are just a few of the big questions that we're failing to discuss in an open, transparent way. If we don't get those most affected and those best positioned to drive change together to address these questions, we'll never be America's most entrepreneurial city. Let's be honest, Kansas City. Honesty is just not one of our strong suits. We're simply being too nice. It's time for that to change. It's time for some tough love, Kansas City.
That was Adam Arredondo of Kansas City Startup Village. His commentary originally appeared as an essay for Startland News. Wondering exactly what he means by Kansas City nice and what its repercussions might be beyond the tech world? Central Standard hosted a really lively conversation about that in March. We even generated a list of key characteristics of Kansas City nice. We'll link to that with the audio from today's show. You'll find everything at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, our food critics recommend Italian and Italian-American restaurants, and with Valentine's Day coming up, we'll give you a primer on crying in restaurants. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.